If the tragedy,
adjective form tragic, necessary for the terms of this sophist introduction,
is a form of serious drama that has only been around as long as ancient Greece, and the universe itself has been around a good deal longer than those halcyon days where men donned masks, performed before great throngs, and stabbed themselves upon hearing the news that they were fornicating with their mothers, well, then it would seem to me that you can't really call the universe tragic now, can you? It's a bit like some technological libertarian referring to a digital world or a binary city. The world wasn't always this way. There were modifiers before digital and binary, and tragic for that matter. Unless, of course, there's some retroactive usage of the newer modifier with the older noun. I don't know if that's allowed. Is that allowed in Scrabble? Is that allowed in novels? Is that allowed in Batsuyudo introductions? I don't know what you've
been told, but I was gonna have okay, so I am here. Once again with Scarlett Thomas, who's most recently the author of Our Tragic Universe. Scarlett, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. First trip to New York, first trip to Brooklyn, so...
And our first meeting, right?
Yeah,
here. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah,
everything in one giant triangulation. So,
yes.
I wanted to, first of all, just start on a basic formalistic question. Our Tragic Universe might be read as a 19th century Russian domestic novel. It might be read as a post-modernist novel in light of the fact that you deal in large part with the futility of narrative. And this leads me to wonder, did you have any kind of multi-formalistic scheme in mind before you started writing this? The kind of multiple interpretations, the multiple themes, the multiple takes that one can do in terms of classifying this novel in any particular genre or whatnot? Or did you just set out to write it? Or did you discover that this had multiple meanings during the course of writing it?
That's a great question. I mean, I like the fact that you picked up on the Russian domestic thing and the kind of post-postmodern thing. But how to answer it? I always like novels that can be read in a number of different ways. I like kind of layered novels where, I certainly like the ending that can be interpreted two ways, like I did in The End of Mr. Y. But this one, I really wanted to try and make the multiple readings integral to your experience of the plot.
Yeah.
So, hopefully the reader gets to the end, realizes the book can be read at least two ways, and then kind of chooses, perhaps on the basis of what they've read. The choosing feeds into the themes, basically.
Yeah. Well, the question is whether you had the multiple forms of reading in mind from the get-go, or whether in writing and concentrating on Meg, it just kind of cropped up over the course of corralling, doing the usual novel of ideas and allowing the novel of ideas to transmute into something totally different. In this case, totally different direction, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of it did build up when I was writing it. I mean, I think with every novel I've written, the final novel hasn't been what I've set out to write, because you can't, if you've got it in your head when you start, it's too small. So, but with this one, so much of it, it's not me as in it's an autobiographical novel, but so much of it comes directly out of my own questions about things, genuine kind of from the heart questions, not just intellectual stuff. So, for example, the whole kind of spiritual aspect of the book, in the end, I've come down in favour of a more realist mode of reading the world, realist but weird mode of reading the world. But I kind of struggle with all of that stuff myself. Am I really a scientist? Am I religious? Am I, if a fairy came up to me, would I believe in it? I'm always struggling with those kinds of questions.
But the question is whether a singular identity, whether as Meg the character or you as the novelist, should even matter. I mean, human beings don't necessarily fit the neat categories, and yet, well, the great irony of this book is that it's very much about how life cannot fit within any kind of narrative container and the like. So I guess the question I have, the reason I'm stuck on this question, is how much of this comes about just by subconscious or accident or just bandying or collecting ideas. I mean, the great irony about some of the conceptual conversations in this book is that you can both read them as a serious discussion, or you can see that it's getting in the way of these characters living out their lives and really recognizing the human foibles around them.
I mean, this one took a lot of really careful plotting.
Yeah.
And the idea is that, the action, which doesn't all resolve, but the action builds up from such small changes in people's lives or their decisions they make based on what they really want or on little connections made years back. But the plot is definitely there, and it was really, really hard to do.
Yeah.
The result is something that I think on a quick or not very careful read can seem unplotted.
Yeah.
You know, like life.
Yeah.
But life is kind of pretty much plotted too, so
yeah.
It was interesting playing with those things, and I did, not much of it happened by happy accident. Most of it was really hard work, actually,
yeah.
This book.
So a lot of this was outlined. I mean, what liberties do you give yourself if, say, like, you know, you get totally caught up in Derrida or something? I mean, you have to give yourself at least a little bit of wiggle room here. And so what is that wiggle room for you?
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of cussing in this book, which I've then kind of fictionalized back into the book because Meg's cussing, and that really came from the heart, because I was doing it myself, albeit in a different way. So for example, I, you know, get really interested in writing about Chekhov, and I wrote pages and pages about Chekhov, and then I end up cussing. You know, it was quite good stuff. I was happy with it, but at the moment where it came, it's as if it was a bit distracting, and I wanted to make the book as lean as I possibly could. So, so yes, I do let myself run away.
Yeah.
But then I usually delete.
Do you keep track of the number of words that you delete at all, or do you?
Yeah, kind of in my head. I reckon for this novel, it was something like 100,000 words of deletion.
Wow.
Not all at once, but just, you know, as I was going along, just thinking, well, that scene doesn't work, it should go, or that scene's twice as long as it should be, so it needs to be cut down.
Yeah.
It's the only time I've ever worked like that.
How many files do you keep of drafts? I'm kind of curious here.
Oh, really a lot. In fact, somehow I've probably got a whole record of every change that's been made to the novel, because
really?
I email it to myself as backup when I'm writing it, so I have all of those. And then each time I'm going to go back and do a major redraft, you know, I kind of save it with a new title, kind of Our Tragic Universe 15.
Yeah.
And then kind of get going. Then the next draft will be 16 and so on.
So you have almost a number of alternative realities here with which to draw from. I mean,
but I never go back.
You never go back. But I mean, I'm curious how many false starts there often are for any given particular moment. Because this is like a huge, these are chunky sections for this book. Unlike some of the other books where they've been in, you know, short staggered chapters. But this one, you know, I mean, one of the reasons why I read the thing so, you know, I couldn't stop reading was because there was no end to the thing, you know. So
oh, good. I'm glad that worked.
Of you.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just curious as to, you know, how you can keep track of something. Where is the ideal thread for you to stop? I'm curious. Like, if you have to stop at a particular moment for any given day, when do you know it's right to stop? Is it the break between sections or what?
What, to kind of to stop working
to stop
for
writing,
the day?
You know.
So for me, so much of it is not really about the novel, but about, does my dog need a walk, or have I got to, you know, mark some work for a university student or something. So I like that. I like practical constraints and distractions, because I think when you're trying to work within those, you often do better work. Having said that, all things being equal, I like to let the novel dictate what happens. I mean, students sometimes ask me, you know, should I be working on my book? You know, how many hours a day should I be working? And I say, some days you probably don't need to do any work.
Yeah.
Some days you'll be at it from 7 in the morning till midnight, but some days you'll just go to the park, or you'll go shopping or do something else, and it'll be turning over in your head. So, and I work like that too. Having said all of that, I do, if I can finish a scene, then I'm happy. I work on the level of the scene, so... Yeah.
I wanted to address one review. Jessica Crispin in the Smart Set. She said, well, you adhere to the two laziest storylines the world of fiction has ever thrown up. Love Conquers All and Secretly a Princess. But to my mind, I thought this was a severe misreading and misunderstanding of the book. I mean, the book is very much concerned with how narrative must rely on contrivances in order to present life. On the other hand, when you have, for example, the deus ex machina of the magic money appearing in Meg's account, this is something of a risky proposition for someone who is accustomed to the sort of page-turner thrillers of your previous books. So I'm curious as to how much you worried or agonized over this coming off of a fairly substantial success, particularly in the UK, and particularly here among bloggers and the like. I mean, did you just not care, or did you worry about people misreading this because you're presenting narrative of a narrative of a narrative, and some people are clearly not picking this up?
Yeah, I mean, God, there's quite a lot there. I read the Jessica Crispin piece, and I felt quite frustrated with it because the reading that she presents is a reading it's set up for you in the book. That this, in fact, it's one character's analysis of what's happened, but the book sets it up as probably wrong. The reason it's there is, I mean, this is just my own reading. Everybody's welcome to read it the way they like, of course. But the idea is that you actively sort of go through and think, oh, aha, so it was the cosmic ordering that gave her the money, and then this and that and the other. Oh my God, everything's sort of prearranged, and there's no free will, and everything's perfectly plotted, and it's just like Kelsey Newman's afterlife. Do I actually want to live like that, or would I rather read it a different way? So that's what you're supposed to be doing with those ideas, and Jessa seems to have kind of stopped a bit too early.
Yeah.
The money device, it's not really a deus ex machina, because Meg has written these novels, and they have been optioned for TV, and she has got the money for it. And I think, as most writers know, you do these things, and everyone's always talking about optioning this and optioning that, and you might get some money and you never do. But then one day you open your online banking and there is some money. And it does kind of change your life. And so, I mean, for me, you know, The End of Mr. Y did so well in the UK and Europe that, you know, there were days where I'd open up my bank account and think, whoa, where's that come from? For the first time in my life, because, you know, I've always been pretty poor. And I wanted to try and write out that experience of suddenly having some money. But of course, it's really hard to do in a novel because, you know, the novel's all supposed to be about drama and struggle and conflict and somebody striving. You're supposed to get the money at the very end of the book. But I wanted to play with the idea of guessing the treasure in the middle and then what happens to life after that. So, but I have to say, you know, Meg is not really a princess, not for me anyway. Yeah. And what was the other thing?
I was going on about how narrative has to rely on contrivances to some degree in order to represent life. But to phrase that in light of your last answer, what I think we're talking about here is the problem of coincidences, which occur in reality and life all the time. And yet when you put them into a novel, then all of a sudden it seems like, oh, that can't possibly happen. And that's the problem of structure, I suspect.
Well, you see, I think another thing I'm trying to do in the novel, maybe not so obviously, or maybe it is obvious, is to look at coincidence and to look at, you know, is the world and our experience of it, is that somehow structured in a scientific, positivist, rationalist way? Is it structured on the spiritualist sort of level? Because that's also, you know, a kind of structure that's imposed. Is it completely random? Or the fourth option, I may have just said there are three, I meant four.
Oh, that's okay. We're not counting here.
Yeah, I don't think you can count. But the fourth option is more interesting for me, and I think it's that there is no structure, but there are lots of people who are aware of lots of different structures, which is interesting. And there are also things that happen that aren't pure coincidence. So they don't just happen out of nowhere, but they happen through plots or series of events leading up to them that are so minute that you almost can't see them.
Yeah.
So, for example, at the towards the end of the novel, Frank and Vi turn up miraculously on the River Dart, where the beast maybe is, and end up taking place in some action there. And for me, I mean, you know, I really liked putting them there because I thought they're there because they read Alice Oswald's poem about the dart. So that's, it's not that they went there randomly by complete chance. Everybody does everything for a reason. I'm really interested in that. And so looking at the reasons why people do things and why that might lead to something else, that's what's really fascinated me in this book. So I really don't believe in complete coincidence. I believe in, you know, choices and desire and motivation of characters, and just how interesting it is when you look at the tiny aspects of that.
You've created, almost by necessity, however, a system and
you know, life is what happens when you make other plans. So I'm not certain if I entirely buy your causist explanation for these characters, because I think you also betray much of the attempt to explain the universe or explain the world around us as I suggested earlier, a trap and a way to avoid, I suppose, living without absolute cognizance. So I'm curious about how you managed to depict this kind of double-edged sword here.
Yeah, I mean, it might, I don't know. I mean, you don't have to buy it, but it's absolutely how I wrote the book. That, okay, I mean, on some level, yes, you do, when you write a novel, you do have to impose some kind of scheme on things which don't have a scheme like that. You know, you need a beginning, a middle, and an end. You need to choose when you take up with the characters, when you let them go, all of that, yes, you do impose a structure. But for me, one of the most interesting moments in the book was when I realised that Arthur Conan Doyle, when he believed in the Cossonay fairies, for him the fairies were more believable than these working class girls who could actually forge pictures of fairies. I found that so fascinating, because for that to be your explanation, because it was impossible for him to believe in the motivation of the girls, for him to think his way into their life and the way they would have planned something. It wasn't just a coincidence. They didn't just happen upon the pictures. They actually made them.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing to imagine. I think it's great and so inventive. And then for him, it was easier to believe in the fairies. So for him, the more believable plot or the more believable story is that fairies exist. And for me, that was a really central image in the whole book.
So even if you don't clutch to the Kelsey Newman-like idea, you still can find solace in either the Conan Doyle fairies or as Meg actually has this childhood flashback where there's this guy who says, "I can teach you magic," which is interesting in light of the fact that her father is very much about finding an explanation for the universe with numbers, and so it seems to me that the burden of these characters is very much to find any kind of explanation, or even the self-help books that Meg must review for this particular column. That this is really, I guess, the onus for almost all the characters. Either that, or you have the option of just tossing your car into the river.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm fascinated with the process of looking for explanations for things and understanding things scientifically, which has always been my urge, even though, I'm not into the kind of, this nouveau atheism movement is not my thing at all, because any explanation that makes sense would be okay for me. Usually it's a kind of scientific explanation, sometimes it's not, but if I'm up in a plane, I want to know how it flies. I want to know why I'm not crashing. If I see, if I see an animal doing something weird, I want to know why that is. I want to know, how does that help them in an adaptive kind of evolutionary way, I want to know why flowers are the colour that they are and why orchids look the way they are. And that's all going to go in the next book, by the way. But
do you believe in anything along the lines of fairies or any kind of situation in which there isn't an immediate explanation? Can you accept a situation or a sight or an observation or a perception for what it is without explanation?
Yeah,
or
that's what the book is about. The book is almost my journey. Well, that makes it sound really
No,
terrible,
journeys are great.
Yeah, I know, but my personal painful journey to come to terms with the unpredictability of the world. It's not quite that, but I both love and hate explanations. That's a big tension in the book. I like things which are unfathomable. I think my favourite word is unfathomable. I like it when you can't work out a reason for something. So my favourite thing is to see a plant doing something and not to be able to look up and find out why it's doing that. The problem with fairies, I don't believe in fairies as such, but I've always liked the idea that because we don't know everything, we can't possibly know everything, we probably know only a tiny fraction of what there is to know. I'm excited by the stuff we don't know.
Yeah.
And the stuff we don't even know we don't know. David Eagleman was talking about this on UK radio the other day really well. And so to kind of close things down and say, okay, all the explanations we have now, that's at the end. I mean, that's not realistic. But what I don't want is, you know, these books that explain to you exactly how the fairy kingdom works and exactly what you have to do to be able to see them and the special magical gifts they'll give you. And that, so they put a kind of schema on the idea of fairies. That's a complete turn off for me. I'm not into that at all.
But this is interesting because you have a situation in this book where Meg is relying upon flimsy science with which to continue and perpetuate her curiosity about something. And so it's almost as if any book, whether it be dubious nonfiction or even solid nonfiction or fiction of any sort, is the ideal method with which to deal with this medium between something that is both explained or unexplained, or this frustration you have with having too many explanations, but yet also being absolutely seduced by that prospect as well.
Yeah, exactly. No, seduced is a great word. No, I think you're right. I think that, you know, the novel of ideas is perfect for this kind of inquiry, because, I mean, especially with so much, you know, not just nonfiction, but, you know, academic writing, there are so many things you can't say, you know, if you're in a sociology department or if you're a physicist, unless you go off and write a novel, I guess, you can't, within your discipline, there are rules and conventions. So, being a fiction writer does free you from all of that. But then again, being a fiction writer, you've also got rules that people expect you to follow, you know, being realistic and, not being too contrived and, you know, all the stuff that Jessa thinks I'm doing, but I don't think I am.
Yeah. Well, it's also the great irony that we're more willing to believe in a lie in fiction than we are to believe in the truth presented in a memoir or nonfiction. You know, there's that aspect too. And that's very, very tricky and very, liberating as a novelist for you. I'm curious if that's part of this draw as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to work with when you're writing a novel, because you always want to do something, astonishing. I mean, I write in the novel about astonishment and Aristotle's idea that you should, you know, when you get to the end of a good tragedy, you should feel astonished, but not completely surprised. It shouldn't be a surprise to you because all the pieces were there all along, but the way they resolve should, you know, really make you kind of gasp. So obviously that's what I want to do. I'm not quite sure if it ever works out, but that's the aim. But you know, when you're writing a novel, roughly what people are going to expect, but also that they're going to expect to not have what they expect. So, and I do work with that quite consciously, but other writers say they don't. I mean, other writers I've heard, because I was on a panel recently with some, say they never think about the audience at all when they write, which I can't imagine. I mean, I write almost as if the novel is a performance and there's a live audience there.
Yeah.
And if I think they're falling asleep or, you know, booing or something, then I kind of delete that bit. And
does this
start,
explain why your novels tend to be quite readable, I would say? I mean, that really, I would say that your work is probably, as novels of ideas go, I mean, it's this sort of strange intellectual page-turner approach, which I can't, you know, I can't necessarily identify other novelists who are just as interesting but are not as interesting in this performance aspect as well. I mean, to what degree is this both positive for you in the sense that you will get readers, but also negative in the sense that, well, are you diminishing or watering down or failing to follow up on some troubling philosophical explanation that's going on in your head? I mean, what are this predicament?
I try not to let it water things down. I mean, that's the balance for me. I know, because, you know, you're kind of writing for an ideal reader or an audience of ideal readers, and for me, they're people who do want to hear a bit about Derrida, or if I say something about, you know, some, you know, the Turing test or something from maths, or if I say something about a quark in physics, that those people would say, gosh, I wonder what that is, that sounds really interesting. So, you know, so then as a writer, I think, oh, okay, if they're thinking that, well, I'm just going to tell them. If they don't want it, they can skip that bit. And I know some people do, but so it's not about watering down, it's not about the kind of entertainment principle where I constantly want people to just be feeling a bit warm and syrupy and happy. I want people to be feeling excited and interested, and like they want to go to the library and look something up.
Yeah.
But so it's not just about making people turn the pages, but I hate the idea of being boring. You know, all my life I've not wanted to be the person who no one wants to talk to at a party, or so I don't want to write books like that. I was a very not very unpopular, I was a very awkward child. You know, it took me years to learn how to kind of talk to people in an interesting way, and so maybe some of it comes out that too.
But on the other hand, you're not necessarily going to appeal to everyone. I mean, you have to sort of accept the fact that, well, you may not be like 100% everybody's cup of tea. And no. So I suppose that, you know, dealing with the people who might inexplicably call you boring, you know, I mean, why be so concerned about something like that?
I guess it's, again, it goes back to this imaginary audience. So,
yeah.
You know, if my... I don't want to be mean to him, he's a very nice guy, but if my hairdresser thought what I'd written was boring, I wouldn't mind, really. But this audience that I've got in my head, if they think I'm boring, then that's wrong.
Yeah.
So, and these are people who can take some Derrida and some maths and, you know, reading about Aristotle and story theory and stuff like that, so...
I wanted to bring up Meg in comparison to Alice and Ariel from the last two books. I mean... You have a situation in which she is in a failing relationship with Christopher. She likes this guy, Rowan, who she kisses, and, you know, it's really, by just about every standard, not that big of a deal, but she thinks that it's a big deal. And this was very interesting to me because of this emphasis on a very guarded domestic situation that almost gets in the way of Meg's intellectual pursuits in this book. I mean, inevitably she pursues them, but she does so, really, she moves to the cottage once she gets the money. And I'm curious why you wanted to create a more reserved protagonist this time around than the previous couple of books. You know, she takes initiative only in her own solitude, and I found that really interesting.
I'm glad you found it interesting. I mean, the thing with The End of Mr. Y was a book that, for me, you know, when I was writing it, had so much momentum because it's an adventure story. It's far more, the deep structure of that novel is far more sort of cliched and old than Our Tragic Universe, which, you know, I'd hoped was quite original in the structure of the way it goes together. But, you know, Ariel finds a cursed book, has to read it,
yeah.
You know, goes on this adventure, and she's saving the world and everything. That, you know, that's what Ariel's like. Meg isn't like that. Meg is somebody who's kind of not made the wrong choice, but made a choice lots of us make, which is to settle down, to hope for some kind of happily ever after. You know, the end of the fairy tale story. But she's stuck in this kind of nightmare of not ever being able to get there. And I really did want to write about that. I think it does happen to so many people. And then sometimes she can't act because another thing I wanted to explore in the novel is the interrelationships of people and how one person making one choice or doing something then impacts on other people. So, you know, Rowan's stuck in his situation. Meg can't just go around his house and sweep him off his feet and, you know, I don't know, kind of shoot his partner or something and,
yeah.
And ride off into the sunset because, you know, real life isn't like that. And I really wanted to explore people being stuck in different ways.
Yeah.
But within a page-turning novel.
Well, the thing that got me, too, about Meg's relationship with Christopher, I was just going, God, why don't you leave this guy? Why don't you leave this guy? All the signs are on the wall. But on the other hand, she's not really telling us what the real in-depth attraction for that relationship is. And I've seen very smart women in such situations. Well, on the other hand, I can also kind of buy some of the... I can understand, rather, some of the criticism that has been leveled about, like, well, if she's so smart... Why doesn't she just really... Why does she take so long to go to the cottage?
She couldn't go to the cottage until she had the money.
Yeah,
I mean, the money is her escape.
Yeah.
And the money, you know, isn't a random event from nowhere. It's because she's kind of worked quite hard. In a sense, that aspect of the book is a bit kind of Protestant work ethic-y. Because,
yeah.
You know, she's done all this hard work and hasn't really earned very much money for it. And then suddenly, you know, one of her geese lays a golden egg or whatever. And I wanted to explore that as well, that often the reality isn't for people that they just decide, oh, I'm a bit unhappy, I'm going to completely change my life, that you often do need a catalyst of some sort. You need some new freedom. The other thing about the relationship with Christopher, I don't know if I got this right particularly, but I wanted to explore a one-sided view of a relationship that's failing from both sides. So I think Christopher's disappointed in Meg as well, because I think he wanted a much more kind of free and easy relationship with somebody who doesn't really wear makeup, wants to hang out, you know, picking fruit on fruit farms, maybe traveling a bit, living a bit a hippie lifestyle. And Meg isn't like that. She may have misrepresented herself as that at the beginning, perhaps. I think people do that in relationships, misrepresent themselves, try and mirror the other person, and then end up stuck with a self that they don't want, and then resentments creep in. So I wanted to explore that quite subtly as well. It was never meant to be that kind of perhaps chick lit story, which I know people are familiar with, that, you know, oh, he's a real nightmare, you know, just leave him. I don't think anyone's a real nightmare. I just think from her point of view.
But she does say, if I were to envision us together decades from now, I'd kill myself.
I mean, that's at the point where she's pretty much ready to leave him. Yeah. She wouldn't have had that thought 2 years before. That's not something she's been thinking for the last 7 years. It was just at that moment she thinks, you know, it was just that conversation prompts her to think that, and then I think that helps her to go.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask about the fact that we don't actually learn Meg's name until about 200 pages into the book, and then you give us the Jesus-like carpenter for the surname.
Oh, yeah.
likewise, in relaying her tale, Meg refers to her dog as B, not as Bess. She only says Bess when she's recording dialogue, and I found that interesting. I mean, I'm wondering if this reluctance to name was your way of nudging the reader towards the futility of narrative, or...
Oh, I like that. It's more, I guess it's more a kind of realist device. And also, I think one of my editors, I can't remember if it was Francis or Jenna, said, we don't hear Meg's name for a long time in the book. Do you think this is a problem? And I said, well, it's going to be on the blurb on the back of the novel.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to know this is a novel about Meg. So although you're supposed to pretend when you're writing that this isn't a novel with a back cover that tells you the characters' names, really it is. And I think for that reason, I mean, that was maybe me being ever so slightly playful, but I thought for that reason I don't need to name her until it's natural to name her, because everyone's going to know she's called Meg anyway.
Yeah.
Because of the back of the book, so...
Got it. And also, this is a conversation I've had with other writers where, you know, if I'm telling a story, I'm not necessarily going to identify myself as name. I mean, I'm just going to be I, so there's that aspect. But I also wanted to ask if Andrew Glass was an homage to Auster. That's what I thought, anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, hang on, I'm just thinking. Yeah, probably slightly.
And also characters' names, like, were Small, Carpenter, Glass, very straight surnames. I mean, surnames that aren't intricate in any capacity. I mean, even Newman, you know, for a new man, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, naming characters, it's a really weird thing to do as an author, because you've got two options, really. One is to name all of your characters in a kind of Martin Amis-esque way. I mean, I love the way he names characters. I'm not quite audacious enough to do it in that way. But to think kind of I'm the author and the god of these characters, and therefore I'm going to name them something meaningful and look up, you know, all the meanings of the flower that I've called them or whatever. Or you go the naturalistic route and pretty much choose them almost by chance. And I go with the second one, really. I mean, even though some people would think it's mad for me to say this, but I am trying to write in a very realist mode, even though I have philosophy and ideas and, you know, fairies and stuff like that in the novels. I am committed to a realist agenda, so for me the characters are named by their parents.
Yeah.
And I try and think, actually, it was an editor years ago said to me, when I was trying to name all my characters really cool things like Trey and Vixen and stuff, and she said, okay, let's think back, how old are they, say they're roughly 25 and they were born in 1970, whatever. Was this a fashionable name then? Would their parents have called them that? And ever since then, I've been really interested in the idea of looking at roughly how old someone is, what their parents would have named them, what was cool then, when I named Rowan Rowan, I deliberately did not look up all the attributes of the Rowan tree and stuff like that, because it was just... sometimes I use name generators on the internet well, just for the random
factor. Just random names that just you can use?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting. I'm wondering if your tendency to use characters named A has something to do with, like, oh, well, here's the A character, or something along those lines.
In Popco, there's an alphabet of characters. So there's Alice, Bob, and so on all the way through. So that was kind of... That was different, but that went with the kind of code-breaking aspects of that novel. I mean, I wanted Meg and Libby to have names that had lots and lots of different diminutive forms. So Margaret and Elizabeth. And Margaret was my grandmother's name, but I wasn't particularly close to her. It was a very random choice, but it means that for that other layer of rejectable plot that's in the novel, you can see, for example, that the woman on Dartmeat, that the beast turns up at midnight, she's called Margaret.
Yeah.
And so, you know, is the beast going around all the Margarets in the area looking for Meg? Or is that just, you know, not a point on the kind of vortex that you need to take into account?
I also wanted to talk about the conversation between Meg and Rowan. Plato's distinction between true stories and false stories, premonitions from authors that predict reality. You have a situation in which Meg is willfully abandoning this novel in progress, and she wants to transform it into a notebook of fragments. She's very proud, even prouder, of the fact that she's only generated 40-something odd words than thousands of words, and that's the number that she can kind of cling to. But I'm wondering if the fact that she has this obstacle between writing a mammoth book and this very concise scenario might be identified as failing to trust in her innate, yet inherently, coincidental premonitions.
Okay, I'm just trying to unpick that. You took that into... I didn't expect where that was going.
Oh, I try to do that, so
no,
feel
that's,
free.
That's
Take
cool.
your time.
Okay. I mean, the fragments idea, I genuinely had that idea at one point for the novel, and I think I was doing a reading from Mr. Y, just a local thing, and people were asking about the new novel, and I said, yeah, it's really cool, it's going to be a notebook, and it's going to be fragments. So I more or less said all those things that Meg says in the novel. I was really proud of it at the time, and then afterwards I just thought, this is just never going to work, this is awful, so I'll just... put it in my novel.
Yeah.
So there's lots of that feeding in. But tell me more what you mean about the premonitions.
The premonitions of authors who can predict reality, like the Titanic situation that is in that particular conversation.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear.
No, okay.
And to me, it's almost as if she can't tackle the novel because she doesn't entirely trust into her own premonitions. This relates to her decisions in life within the narrative, which makes this a very interesting situation. But I just wanted to ask you a little bit about this.
Yeah. I mean, so many novels are kind of predictive, or they seem as if they're premonitions of something. And I think that's an interesting factor about working in a realist mode as well. I mean, the way they unpick the Titanic novel is that it's all entirely plausible. And in fact, this comes back to the idea of the plot, the coincidence, and real life, that the Titanic did sink. If you go back and look how it was built, what people said about it, all of those kind of plot factors, of course it was a boat like it would sink. It's there as a possibility. The story is there waiting for an ending, really. So, so it's pretty likely that a novel would have a similar structure. I'm really interested in exploring that kind of thing. I've probably done it better in the book than I've talked about it just now, but
fair enough. Well, I have a very important question for you, and that is the situation involving the tangerines, which I understood replaced cigarettes. Why a tangerine over, say, a clementine or an orange or even an apple? Or was it possibly a reference to the fact that she plays guitar and Tangerine, the Led Zeppelin song, is so easy to play? I'm going to go ahead and just give you all sorts of crazy interpretations, but I'm hoping to get the answer from you.
No, this is a really interesting question. I have to give this serious thought. I prefer oranges to apples, so we're left with the orange, the tangerine, and the clementine. There's also the satsuma. There was one point in the novel where I had her eating both oranges and tangerines. I don't like clementines, so we'll leave those off.
Yeah.
Tangerines and satsumas I think of as the same thing. So we're down to oranges and tangerines.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to make it kind of consistent as her thing that she does. So I came down in favour of tangerines. Why? Because they're easier to peel.
Yeah.
And for example, in that scene where she's on the ferry with Rowan, I wanted her to be able to peel something easily, chuck the peel over the side of the ferry,
yeah,
and just eat it rather than, you know, get all that gunge in her fingernails. And
holding a small world in your hands as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Kelsey Newman, which we've talked about. He's the writer within the book who offers this Omega Point theory, which I'm going to mangle my French, so I apologize in advance, but it's based off of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, which I totally probably screwed up, but anyway.
I totally even don't know that, because I got it all from the Frank Tipler book. I haven't heard of this French guy.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So
I know I should pretend I have, but I haven't.
Well, in any event, I wanted to ask, based off of that, I mean, we're talking about the supreme point of material complexity and consciousness. Now, Teilhard, he was more interested in the idea of the Omega Point being this particular area where the universe must expand and consciousness evolves. Yet, with Kelsey Newman, it's all about, nah, we're going to go ahead and hit the reset switch. And I'm curious as to why you made that particular choice for fiction. I mean, I'm wondering if the idea of expansion of a novel might somehow be applicable to the Teilhard, well, the novel itself, even though it's a fixed object, it might actually evolve in some sense in terms of expanding consciousness based off of reader perception.
Okay. I think we're dealing with two different Omega points here.
Yes.
Very different Omega points. And my one, well, it's not mine, Kelsey Newman's, comes from the Frank Tipler book. So, and I don't think Frank Tipler's working off these ideas.
No.
I think they're two separate
digression
things.
Digression of the Omega.
Yeah. Because for Frank Tipler, this is, this is the moment where science becomes religion. This is the moment where science has created everlasting life, and the point at which this happens is the kind of entity that contains everything. That's the Omega Point. So the Omega Point is God, but it's more than God. It's science. It's very fascinating, and I mean I came upon those ideas in one of my other capacities. I think I was just reviewing a science book that mentioned this, and I thought I often have this kind of thought where I think, wow, so cool, and then 2 minutes later, shit, so scary. And then I know that's something I want to dramatize, because you know, a lot of people, if you say to them, hey, how would you like to live forever? Yeah, brilliant. But then when you think about what that would actually be like and what it would actually mean, it's kind of awful. And, you know, I'm partial to a bit of yoga and Zen meditation and stuff like that, and contemplating the void. And this idea of something that would prevent you from getting to the void, it seems like it's a very safe kind of Western, it's an American thing to do, or a British thing to do, kind of, okay guys, let's stay safe, we're not going to go into that void, the unknown is unknown, we don't want it, we're going to make sure everything is known.
Yeah. We can't accept it, so therefore we're going to come up with theories that involve the reset switch.
Yeah, exactly. So rather than, I mean, you know, obviously it's a key part of the themes in the book, rather than go into the unknown, which might be nothing, it might be so disappointing, it might be the end of everything, but it could be ultimate enlightenment, it could be, you know, merging with the kind of, you know, mass consciousness or anything, rather than to do that in a natural way, to come up with an artificial version that is like a horrible trap, it's like a terrible prison. So I absolutely had to write about those ideas. I mean, it gave, reading about the Omega Point and Frank Tipler's ideas gave me a crisis similar to the one I had when I first watched The Matrix.
So that came from your own particular reality, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I loved the first time I watched The Matrix, because I had no idea what it was about, and then suddenly seeing all these people in pods, but it was that great thing that film does, and that for me really great fiction does, which is to turn something around on you and to ask you, what if this was real?
Yeah.
What if this was you? This could be your life now. What would you do about it? I love that. I mean, it's a kind of, it's a sense of interactivity where you don't have to do it, you don't have to press any buttons, you just are in the plot. But I was depressed for ages after watching The Matrix. I thought, oh no, this is, you know, humanity's doomed. I'm quite suggestible like that. And other science articles I've read about, you know, what if we're in a petri dish, a kind of, you know, cosmic petri dish, or what if we're in an experiment, or what if this and what if that. And for me, you know, that kind of crisis of who we might be or who we want to be is just absolutely fascinating to write about.
Well, I want to tie in the Omega point with the fact that you evoke Hamlet in relation to Zeb Ross, this mysterious, illusory figure that is created in this book involving orb books. There's the idea that Meg has where Hamlet could not be written today, particularly in the framework of Zeb Ross, but on the other hand, the suggestion, for me at least, seemed to be that that Hamlet could not be written today, that the circumstances of our world have changed, that the universe has expanded. And to tie this in to something that the scholar Howard Jenkins has observed about Hamlet, that within the first 150 years, Hamlet was considered this really courageous and bold and heroic figure. And in the last few centuries, he's been interpreted as someone who is crippled with indecision. Now, I'm curious if whether perception of anything you write or natural omega points of the universe that would cause changes of consciousness, that would also cause changes in reader perception, is anything that you might actually in fact be concerned about, and whether in fact you have thought about the Jenkins scenario of how Hamlet has shifted over the last several centuries.
Well, Hamlet hasn't, not for everyone has Hamlet shifted to being the kind of, you know, the prince of indecision, because, you know, Nietzsche writes, that's absolutely not what Hamlet is. Hamlet is somebody who so deeply understands the, you know, the horrible mystery of being alive that he's kind of, he's on this tragic course to destroy himself and as much as he can about, you know, everything. So, so it's not that Hamlet can't decide, it's that there aren't any choices to be made, and Hamlet knows that. That's what's so tragic. So so there are three Hamlets then, and probably more, but that's one of the reasons Hamlet is so wonderful, that, you know, every age can look at Hamlet and see, you know, see themselves reflected somehow, or see something of their time reflected in Hamlet. So if I were to write something enduring that way, God, that would be great, wouldn't it? It's unlikely, but...
particularly in our sort of disposable culture and all that, too.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps... I mean, that's interesting. When I write, I definitely... I don't want to write something that will, you know, in 20 years' time, not be relevant or not make any sense. I do want to deal with universal themes, even in something like Bright Young Things, which is... It was written almost as a kind of time capsule, you know, in 1999, where I deliberately mentioned, you know, bands and products and things that were around then. I knew it would date in about 2 years, but I wanted the universal aspects of it to kind of stay around. I also, I suppose I don't want to write things that are too ephemeral or that give you a thrill and then you forget them. I mean, I read books like that a lot, and that's absolutely what I don't want to. I mean, for some people, I'm sure my books are that. I'm sure it's not the same for everybody, but I want to write things you could reread and get more out of them.
Does this explain why in our tragic universe, the technology itself is, I mean, in terms of the internet and in terms of cell phones and mobiles and all that, it's really not so specific. I mean, if you take a book like, for example, Richard Powers's Generosity, which I think is a great book, that book is all about capturing the present moment. It's almost as if he realizes that, well, there's nothing I can do. The world is changing so fast, and so I have to chronicle as much of it now as I can, even though if you read this 20 years from now, people go like, oh, well, what the hell was this? I mean, I'm wondering if there is an inherent risk in being a novelist of ideas now, because the world changes faster than it probably ever has in the history of humankind.
Yeah, you see, I think things don't really change. I think things are pretty much the same. I mean, I don't believe in anything as lame as human nature, but I do believe that, you know, basic urges and desires of, you know, throughout all time, people want love, they want comfort, they want you know, some money or whatever the equivalent is, and people are motivated to act because of those things. You know, they also want whatever's kind of, whatever's deemed cool by their culture at that time, or maybe some people don't want that because they don't, you know, want to follow the herd. And I think if you can keep to those universals, you know, like, I mean, Tolstoy is such a great writer of universals. And you know, you read Anna Karenina now, and all the feelings, absolutely what people feel now. The technologies are different.
Yeah.
People are riding around, you know, actually they're on trains a lot, so I spend half my life on trains, but you know, someone's riding in a coach, that's not so different from being in a yellow cab if you're having the same conversation, yeah. That, you know. So, and I think writing in a realist way about the technologies of your time is a really important thing to do for history. I mean, you know, so many of my colleagues, all the historicists, they have great fun looking at, you know, bridges in the 19th century or carriages or postage stamps or, you know, horses. And I think that's a really fascinating way of doing history, doing it through literature. So I think as a writer, I mean, they're not just looking at those objects or material culture, they're looking at, you know, they're looking at culture, language, people through those objects. So I think to be as realistic as possible with that stuff is a really great thing.
I'm absolutely with you on the idea that human emotional needs have certainly not changed, but technology is certainly affecting the way in which we express them. And so I'm wondering, that I guess that's what I mean by the idea of humankind's history, right? Or human history right now is changing at such a clip. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, people weren't having discussions with strangers while sitting at a table in a cafe on a cell phone. I mean, you know, even 10 years ago. I mean, it fundamentally changed the way that we live in some sense. I mean, don't you think that this would have a bearing on portraying emotional needs in fiction?
I think the main thing that's changed, and this could be just me that I'm speaking for, is the speed at which you can live. You know, the idea of the accelerated culture. So the amounts of interactions you could have in a day, or, for example, how quickly now a relationship can be accelerated. And, you know, this passed me by because, the internet was invented during my last relationship, and my new relationship is with somebody, you know, who can just about send emails, but it, you know, isn't into technology at all. So I've never had the thing where, I mean, my students do, yeah. Where, you know, you go on a date and you might text someone the next day. I've never had that, or that you might kind of become friends with someone on Facebook, or then go to this stasis of in a relationship or not. I mean, I see my, you know, my brothers and my friends, my students doing this stuff, and I think, shit, I'm glad I didn't have to operate in that way. I mean, for me, it was all about, you know, if someone rings up and you don't want to talk to them, you get your mum to say that you're out.
Sounds to me like you've done a thorough, like, isolation or insulation so that you can, in fact, concern yourself with these emotional needs in fiction and in your work and all that.
I'm not insulated. I see the relationship stuff happening and I'm pleased I don't have to do it, but then I can't really find my way around a city without BlackBerry Maps. And, you know, I landed last night, got here, and so, you know, the first thing I'm unpacking is my BlackBerry charger, my laptop. This morning I had to physically stop myself Googling America eggs meaning of over easy to try and kind of, I thought, no, I'm just going to live through this.
Just go ahead and find out what it is on your own, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's what I thought. That's why I stopped myself, because I thought, well, this is the kind of thing you can do now.
If you experience it, you're more likely to remember it and you're more likely to feel it, I suppose.
But you can, I think Google can stop you from, everybody knows this, I'm not saying anything new, but it can stop you from actually finding things out for yourself if you can just kind of, you know, ask it a question and it tells you.
To shift this in a vocational context, is the Google versus experiential problem applicable towards novel writing or fiction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think most people agree that, you know, there you are, writing a novel on your laptop, you've got Google open and your email open at the same time, and the temptation to just Google everything is pretty strong. So I've heard, who was it? It may have been Louise Welsh, but I might be wrong. Sorry, Louise, if I am. But I think she said that she just can't have anything like that open. She just, you know, types away, never looks anything up while she's rising. I'm a bit prone to it, mainly because I'm so terrified of guessing anything wrong.
Yeah.
That sometimes what I look up most often is things I already know, but just to check they're right or to check spellings. But if I really want to find out about a new theory of something or what Nietzsche said about Hamlet, I'll go and sit down with a book.
Yeah. But isn't there some sort of liberation in being wrong?
Oh.
I mean, isn't
wouldn't
it fun
be
to be
great?
Wrong?
No, it's awful.
It's,
I mean,
it's awful always?
Well, it's just one of my hang-ups. I don't think it's objectively awful, but just for me, you know, sometimes if you're having a conversation with somebody and they, you know, say they want to talk about Bob Dylan and they say something like, you know, I don't know, I can't think of Bob Dylan being anybody else, but, you know, get the name wrong and you know they're wrong and they haven't noticed, but you know what they mean and you so you don't say anything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I would hate to be that person who's used the wrong name or said the wrong thing or been a bit uncool. I don't know. It's just...
Well, you know, it's kind of fun. I mean, there's a certain creative aspect of mishearing things or getting something slightly wrong, and then you kind of come to terms with the correctness or the incorrectness of it, and it kind of merges with your consciousness, I would say.
No, you're absolutely right. Intellectually, I'm there with you, and I think it depends on the thing. I just don't like being embarrassingly wrong. In the end of Mr. Y, I spelled Edgar Allan Poe wrong. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And I was really embarrassed about that because I had a friend called Alan, spelled A-L-L-E-N, yeah. And I just was so used to writing that down. And then nobody changed it. I didn't think to change it. And then, you know, I do find that kind of thing really embarrassing because it's like, I'm this person who can't spell Edgar Allan Poe. Well,
yeah. You know, but there are a lot of people can. A lot of smart people sometimes make mistakes.
I like it that a lot of mathematicians can't do simple arithmetic. I mean, that's always made me feel better because I can't either.
Well, I think that seems to be a sort of hopeful but strange note to conclude this conversation. But Scarlett, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you again. And hopefully we'll talk again.
So. Thank you. Yes, right. I hope so. Circulation. Join the degeneration. In my room, the whole flies high. You wrapped you in my loving eye. Won't it dream it?